cliffcentral.com.
So, sitting opposite me is one of the men who, and I don't often give compliments in the radio business because most people in radio are terrible people. But this guy, in many ways, revolutionized morning radio. He has had a track record unsurpassed in commercial radio in terms of audience, revenue, and everything else. And when he was doing the morning show on 94.7 all those years ago, it was a cultural artifact more than it was an entertainment show. And I'm delighted to have, and it's the first time we've actually got together in years, none other than, and put your hands together, for Jeremy Mansfield. I'm going to have the full fanfare for you.
Jeez.
Nice, huh?
You're too kind.
No, but it's all what I just said. You can't dispute that you had highest ratings, highest revenue that they ever had.
Yeah, it was. It was. It was one of the. If you take the cost of what it took to put that show to air, yeah, and the revenue that it generated, it was one of the top 10 earning radio shows in the world.
There we go. See?
Yeah.
Now listen.
And it was fun.
It was, and it lasted a long time too, which morning shows don't usually.
No, they don't.
Because management don't know what they're doing, so they either fire them before they've got into it.
Or they get paranoid about the personality becoming bigger than the radio station.
Which, by the way, thanks to social media, we know now to be true.
Yeah.
Nobody cares about radio stations.
Yeah,
nobody
exactly
cares about TV channels. No. If you like a show, let's say
you like the show.
You like the show.
RuPaul. That's my favorite television show. I was talking to Talani about it. I love RuPaul.
Yeah.
Love RuPaul's Drag Race.
I honestly have never seen it. Is it worth watching?
Oh, Gareth. You do not know what you're missing.
It is quite impressive. The transformations that happen on that show are stunning. And a lot of the guys there end up looking far more attractive than the ladies. It's quite amazing.
So Mizzy told me a story backstage when we were getting the show was, they were setting up lights and things for Idols the one day, and he said to me, he used to do drag shows.
Yeah.
And he said, you cannot believe the bitchiness and the nastiness goes on. He said, you think Miss South Africa's bad. These drag queens, they'll sabotage each other. They'll put pins into garments. They will put poison into makeup. They will do the most terrible things to each other. Is this the kind of thing they show on RuPaul?
Yep.
Oh,
yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, then it would be worth the watch.
It's great fun.
All right, I'll get into that.
Ladies, it is time to lip sync for your life.
Is that what they say?
Yep. Because what happens is at the end of RuPaul, you get two contestants who one of them is going to be knocked out, and then they have to lip sync, and they usually have an artist, a singer, on the panel for that. So it would be one of that singer's songs that they have to lip sync to. And that's how he ends off. He says, ladies, it is time to lip sync for your life and don't fuck it up. It's just beautiful.
Now listen, what have you been up to? Because I read the other day you're now going into politics. Is this true? And by the way, Jeremy's getting over a horrible, he says it's flu.
It has been
what
a flu.
What kind of person has flu in summer?
Well, I don't know. There's something doing the rounds because I had it, my wife had it. I've got two friends who've got it at the moment. And it's a really nasty little virus that's going around.
You got to stop these swingers clubs, really. That's
this all started back 2 years ago when I was at my brother-in-law's 60th birthday party, and I was approached by an old schoolmate of mine, Ross Purden, who's now an MP. At that time, he was an MEC in the Eastern Cape.
All right.
He's with the DA, and he said to me, you know what, we need people like you in the Alliance. And I started thinking about it, and then I was engaged by Mike Moriarty, who's the chief whip of the DA here in Gauteng. And so this discussion has been doing the rounds. And when I was down in the Eastern Cape this last Christmas, Ross Purden sat me down and he bent my ear again. And I thought to myself, you know what? You either make a decision or you don't. And so I made the decision to make myself available for selection, which I will go through the normal selection process.
Like anybody else.
Anybody else for the DA to stand in the 2019 elections.
So you are doing it. That's an interesting move. And I think that's quite cool.
Yeah, it is. Look, if it comes off, if I am elected, it'll be hard work. But I've never really shied away from that.
So where does it start? Do you run in your local sort of ward, or
that will be up to the party. The party will determine how that runs.
But it's not going to be very helpful if they decide to send you off to Cathcart or something. You don't want that.
What the sort of broader plan is that I would have to run in a ward, but that I would be possibly placed in Parliament.
That would be amazing.
Because that is probably where I would be able to make most of a difference. I was approached years ago by a university in the United States. They had a professor who was doing a research project on what makes you happy personally. Mm-hmm. And they said they were looking for as broad a base of people to do the research project with him. And it entailed you doing a survey, which they said would take – it's an online survey, which they said would take about five hours to do. And they said – If you're prepared to do that, in return, he will give you a personal analysis of yourself and what makes you happy, you.
Okay. All right.
And the first thing that he determined that makes me happy is making other people happy. And I think this is another part of that process in my life. You know, I've made people happy through laughter in media. I've made people happy through charity work that I've done. And I think this is now a chapter where I can make people happy through change that needs to be made in this country and that can be made.
And also, I think there's something about politics that even though there are a lot more young people in politics, you need to have a certain – it's not an age thing. It's a maturity thing, and it's a level of kind of a need to give back almost.
Yeah, and I think you do get to a certain age where you have that need to give back to people, to communities, and I've sort of hit that stage.
And where you could see the wood for the trees, right? I mean, you know what's nonsense and what you shouldn't have to get engaged in.
Yeah.
Where I find myself, well, certainly up to at least a few years ago, you get pulled into arguments that aren't your problem. And you start having conversations with people who aren't that interesting to you anyway. Mm. I don't think I want to do that anymore. For you, politics would be somewhere you can make a real difference. You can have conversations with the people who matter.
Yeah. And also maybe try and fix some things that need to be fixed.
Sure, but wasn't there a part of you that said, I'm not getting into this mess?
There was a part of me that said, you've got to grow a thick skin, because I'm the sort of person who I can get 99 compliments and then one person says, you're an arsehole. And
that's all you remember.
That's all you remember. And I've already found that on social media since I made this announcement and since the DA put out the statement that I was making myself available. I've had that sort of – I mean, there was a guy who came on onto my Facebook page a few days back and accused me of spousal abuse.
Yeah, what was that all about? Because I didn't know about it. And someone said to me, oh, when you have Jeremy on, because they heard I was going to have you on the show, you must ask him about beating his wife. What is this?
I don't know where that came from. He suddenly said
you've never gone to – no one's ever laid any charges against you of that.
No, he put a post up saying, oh, if you're going into politics, then what's your opinion on spousal abuse? Because I believe you abused your ex-wife. I said, I'd like to know your – I replied. I don't usually reply, but I replied and I said, I'd like to know your source because I will sue them.
Yeah.
He said, oh, I can't remember. It was so many years ago. And my ex-wife was so incensed that she actually wrote a letter, which I then posted on my site, stating that she had never, ever been abused in any way by me at any time in our relationship.
Well, it's ridiculous. Isn't it crazy you even have to do that?
Yeah, I know. It's ridiculous.
Because there's so much fake news going on, right?
Yeah.
And people make stuff up. I mean, last year there was this, I had to deal with the Sunday Times in a similar way with this whole Mara Lowe story that they completely made up.
Yes.
And I had to threaten them again with the lawyers, and then they made an apology the week afterwards. But the apology is always this big.
Yeah.
It's about the size of a 1 rand coin, if you're lucky. And the article itself is
the story was exactly. No, it's ridiculous. And I think it's also indicative of the levels of journalism these days, which I honestly do believe that media in general. The levels of
it's a toilet bowl.
It's just going down and down.
All right. Now, when you were on radio,
yeah,
it wasn't like this. You mostly the I don't like to sound like I'm complaining about what we've currently got, because in some ways it's great. Social media is terrific. It's created a place where everybody's voices can be heard. There's lots of good.
Yeah.
But there's also lots of really irresponsible bullshit, like the story about you being a wife beater.
Yeah.
What other shit have you had to deal with post and while you were on radio? That, because people do, they like to have a story, even if it's not true. And you hear things about yourself and you think, my God, is this even, I don't even recognize myself in any of this.
Mm.
Who hates me so much they'd sit and cultivate?
Gareth, I don't know if it's people hating you so much. I think it's just people who are bored and they've got nothing better to do than sit on social media and dream up stuff. And it's almost like their little 15 minutes of fame.
Yeah.
They can turn around and say, well, I got one over Gareth Cliff.
But does it annoy you that for at least the last few years, you didn't have your own microphone there all the time to be able to hit back when people were saying things?
No, it didn't, because I didn't miss the microphone at all.
At all?
No.
Really, Jeremy?
No.
After all those years, and yeah. It was such a thing for you?
No. The time was right.
Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing. I mean, you stepped away from it, and there were a lot of people who said, oh, you know, Jeremy didn't leave, he was pushed. You know, you usually get that kind of controversy too, where people can't believe that something that's so successful just comes to an end.
Mm.
But then to move on and to do, and I know you brought out books about food, you and your wife got very involved in animal charities, you did some really interesting trips all over the world. So it's not as if you haven't had a meaningful life. But to that audience that loved you so much, you were suddenly not there anymore. And I think for them it was more a case of trying to deal with that than it was for you.
Yeah, because I had made that decision. You know what I mean? To the audience, it was a decision made almost on their behalf. So they weren't part of the decision. I'd gone through the process. I'd processed it already. I'd worked out why I was doing it, how I was doing it, and what I was going to do after it. And I've had a lot of fun after it. You know, we've managed to travel a lot more because when I was on air, our time that we could travel was very restricted.
Yeah.
It also means we can travel outside peak season, you know, which is great because everything's cheaper, you don't have everybody else there, you know. That's also an important aspect of it. So we've done some really interesting trips. The last big one we did was end of last year. We went to the Antarctic.
Wow! Now tell me about that.
Oh,
it's a fascinating place.
Well, you know what?
One of the few places humans haven't completely destroyed yet.
Yeah. It's very difficult to describe because it literally is, it's like being on another planet.
By the way, you must really love your wife and she must really love you to go to a place as barren as Antarctica and enjoy each other's company for the duration. You don't go to Antarctica for a 5-day, you know, in and out. It's quite a thing. It's an ordeal.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, we've left Valparaiso and went down the Chilean fjords, then did Drake's Crossing and into the Antarctic, and then back to St. George Island and up to Brazil.
So it was, what, three weeks?
Three and a half weeks, I think, yeah.
Let's start at the beginning because I'm fascinated with that part of the world and I've never been there. So obviously you've got like Tierra del Fuego, you've got the whole Patagonian thing going on in the south of South America, which is largely an unspoiled wasteland.
Yeah.
No humans have come there to ruin it yet. But you've got amazing animal life. You've got incredible weather. And is the crossing, Drake's Crossing, is that Cape of Storms, is it as violent and deadly as it used to be for all those seafarers years ago?
Well, we were very, very lucky because we hit Tierra del Fuego. And the captain, we were on a seaborne ship, and the captain made an announcement and said, the weather outlook is very good. So he's going to push the ship. And we got through Drake's Passage. It usually takes 2 days. We got through in one. And it was a lake. It was an absolute lake. So we were incredibly fortunate there. But then you get into Antarctica, and it, as I said, it is a different world. The one day we'd been out, because every day you go out on the zodiacs and you go walking in penguin colonies and all the rest of it. Because if you are going to Antarctica, you need to go with a small cruise liner. And Seabourn have a ship that is takes about 180 people. So you can then disembark. The big ships, they don't allow
– too many people.
Don't allow them to disembark.
And those animals, those penguins and so, they don't know what to do with humans. So they don't consider us a threat. So no. You just walk among them.
And also they're certain the staff on board – go out and they predetermine routes so that you're not walking into
nests.
Areas where there are nests and that sort of thing. But the one day we'd come back from walking, and I went to the front of the ship and jumped into the hot tub, right at the front of the ship. And I was the only person in the hot tub. This is about 3 p.m. And the next thing I just heard, almost next to me, because I was right in the bow. Just heard this, and I looked, and there was this spray came up. And within about 2 minutes, there must have been about 20, maybe 30 humpback whales just all breaching.
Wow.
Around the front of the ship, around the bar. Jesus,
did you just burst into tears? Because that's the kind of thing
I just sat there, and my hair just stood up.
Jesus.
And the captain then pulled back the ship, because he was going slowly in any case, and he pulled back the ship. And he made an announcement about 5 minutes later, and then everyone streamed to the front of the ship. But for about 5 or 10 minutes, I sat there alone with humpback whales breaching around me.
Now, you talk about what makes you happy. I mean, that kind of memory just, you know, if you died 15 minutes later, you probably would have died with a smile on your face.
And people say, oh, did you take a photograph? And you go, no, I don't need a photograph. That photograph is in my brain. It's there already. So, yeah, that was fascinating. Our next trip is we're going to Nepal to go and track snow leopard.
Wow.
Yeah. Have you seen that that BBC Planet Earth thing? And they track the snow leopards with cameras.
No,
it's the most amazing documentary.
Was it part of Planet Earth too?
Yeah, they're the most solitary animals you can find.
By the way, we've got the producer of that series on next week. He's going to pop by, so I'll tell you more about that in the next couple of days. But sorry,
like one of the documentaries is mountains, so they go and they track these things. Yeah. It's fascinating. Those things are so rare; they don't even look real. They look like they're animated slightly.
Yeah,
like you just never see them.
Yeah,
but yeah, wow.
I hope you find one.
Yeah, me too.
Well, it's the experience.
I mean, it's tough enough finding an ordinary leopard in the Kruger National Park.
Why don't you find a Yeti for us? But now, well, are you happy? I mean, it sounds to me like you've got a really, really good life going on. You and Jackie are very happy. You've got, you know, a possible political career on the horizon, which for good and bad reasons, I think the country should be happy about, because the more anyone like you could bring to this, the more interesting it would be. There are certainly politicians with personality, but not a lot of them. And I think a lot of people with personality stay away from politics because it's so fractious and so ugly.
Yeah.
But I'd love to see what happens there. And then your daughter's doing very well. Where's she at the moment?
She's in the UK, and she is just starting a job this month. I think she's a bit like me in some ways.
Yeah.
She's always wanted to work in community stuff. And she's starting work in a community project. I think you probably, if I had to describe it, I'd describe it in local terms as a child protection unit.
Really?
Yeah. So that's what she's going to be doing in the UK. She's very happy.
People accused you. They said that you were probably going to leave the country and that you didn't care about South Africa, and why should you not go into politics? There's another one of these people who complained about you.
Look, I'll be honest, there was a time where I was considering leaving.
Well, let's be honest about it, because I'm sure everybody has these thoughts from time to time, especially when they read shitty news headlines.
Yeah, and that wasn't because of anything happening in the country, really. I was at one stage leaving because of tax reasons. I was very unhappy paying the rate of tax, the high rate of tax that I was paying to a government that was doing nothing for its people. You know, if I could see development happening in the country with the utilization of my tax money, I'd be happy to see that. If I saw schools being built in towns like Lusikisiki in the Eastern Cape, if I saw people being housed properly, I would be happy to pay those taxes. But I wasn't seeing that. And so I did consider that. And that's one of the reasons why I've made myself available to the Democratic Alliance for the 2019 elections, because I've now made a commitment that I will stay in the country. And having made that commitment, I have to now make a commitment to the country itself.
Right.
So that was one of the reasons why I came to this decision.
So you are happy?
Yeah, I'm still working fairly hard. We've got a property development company, and we've got a huge project that we're working on that's coming off in Cape Town. Mm-hmm. I think at the moment, really, when I was on radio, I think I was fairly wise in my investments. So we have, we've got property here and in Cape Town and in the UK and in Vancouver, and it's really managing those investments now.
Well, that's a lot to do.
And that is a lot to do. You know, you've got to keep on top of it, and you've got to make sure that they are properly managed. And you know, we've got a share in an aircraft, and so it's keeping
you've
on top.
You've got a lot going on.
Yeah, it's keeping on top of all that sort of stuff.
Now, do you ever have to? Because this happens to all of us. We get a bit cynical, and especially as we see more, we learn more. We kind of there's, you know, it's the idea of as you watch the world turning around you, and you become older and wiser, you're inclined to become a little bit less kind of carefree and full of bounce and a little more cynical and jaded about things. Do you have to guard against that? Do you actually sit there and go, no, I mustn't be curmudgeonly old arsehole. I've got to focus on trying to be a little bit more bouncy.
Yeah, you're right. We do. and we worry more about things that we didn't worry about when we were younger. You know what I mean? Like investments and those sort of things. Oh. You know, I remember when I started work in media in 1986 at Capital Radio. I think my first pay slip was 320 odd rand for the month. Wow. And I lived like a king on that, and I didn't worry about money. But now once you've accumulated some form of wealth, you have to start maintaining it and seeing that it works for you. So you almost get paranoid about it.
Yeah.
And you've got to guard against that. So every now and again, I do find myself in that space, and I've got to pull back and go, hey, whoa, hang on, boy. Just calm down.
Things are good. You're okay.
Yeah.
You just got to worry less about it.
Yeah, exactly.
But worrying is also a thing. It's worrying about your family, worrying about your finances, worrying about your health. All this kind of thing. These are things that people start to become focused on.
And you know what? The worrying is actually probably the worst thing for your health.
Apparently, that's the thing that kills you.
Yeah, exactly. So you have to step back and just go, you know what?
No, I mean, you're an Eastern Cape boy at heart. I mean, that's where you come from. That's kind of that's where you were. You know, what's going on?
No, I'm just getting a tissue.
Oh, geez, do you want to cry?
No, he's sick. I can't.
So you get up. I thought, oh shit, we've offended him. He's on his way out.
Right.
When you come from the Eastern Cape, there's a kind of a pull back to that in some ways. Do you ever you've obviously been back to visit, but do you ever think how different your life could have been? You were at Rhodes. You've got family there, obviously.
Yeah.
Do you ever think what kind of a life you might have had if you'd stayed in like Port Elizabeth or something?
No.
You don't want it, right?
No. No.
No. Bathurst. Come on.
Bathurst.
Yeah.
But. Fondin. Yo. They've
got a pineapple.
A patisi.
That's all they've got. A pineapple, and they have an ox braai every year.
They have an ox braai. And they have the oldest running pub in the country. The Pig and Whistle.
Okay. Is that it's a famous pub?
Yeah, it's the longest running licensed pub in South Africa.
You still drink a lot of beer?
No.
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 You don't drink?
No.
Have you stopped completely?
What a loss to
the beer industry.
I relapse every now and again. But
Jesus, Jeremy, this is very bad for breweries. Do they know about this?
That's why my mate Antonio Rossetti is taking early retirement at the end of this month.
And they sold
the company off.
Wow.
Yeah, you know what? I do love the Eastern Cape. I love the people. I think one of the reasons I think I was successful on the radio was because I came from a community of storytellers.
Frontier people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
Did you read Alistair Sparks? He wrote a really good book, obviously before he died last year.
Yeah.
He wrote an amazing book about his history. He goes into this whole thing of the Eastern Cape because he's also from there.
Yeah.
And he wrote about these frontier people. And how they also have a unique understanding of kind of black and white.
Yes.
And of English and Afrikaans. Mm. And of many of the things that we're still dealing with as a country. But it's a place where there's a lot of stories to be told.
There are. And there's some beautiful stories. There's also an affinity there between... which I don't find anywhere else in South Africa. I mean, all of my cousins and relations down there are almost every single one is absolutely fluent in isiXhosa.
Mm-hmm.
And when people talk, they will talk in the vernacular.
Yeah, they bounce around.
And they have the ability to tell stories. I mean, they're stories that I've heard that you could tell in 30 seconds, but they've taken 30 minutes to be told because of the embellishment. And it's there's not necessarily a punchline to them, but it's just the way that the story's told. You know, my wife actually thought that I was exaggerating when I was explaining to her how. Before she met my family, she'd have to learn to speak like somebody from the Eastern Cape. But
which is how you speak.
That's how you speak, young. Young, Fondin. That's how you talk when you're in the Eastern Cape. And she would also have to learn a whole lot of stuff about pineapples. Because otherwise people wouldn't want to talk to her, young. And she thought I was bullshitting when I spoke like this.
And then when she got
there. When she got there, everyone is talking like that. And she thought they were pulling the wool over her eyes until she realized that's actually how they talk.
One of the things, it's a small thing, but it was an important part of what you kind of used to do that people loved. And it's something that's part of who you are as well. And it comes from the storytelling thing, is your ability to mimic people and your ability to draw the funny stuff out, almost like a cartoonist exaggerates someone's nose or someone's shoulders or whatever it is, and then they draw them and that's how they look, or a shower head or whatever it is. So in this case, you would take those things out of the way they sounded. And you had characters, and I could immediately see what the character that you were doing looked like in my head. Mm. That's a rare and unique ability.
I think that comes from, firstly, the storytelling background that I come from, but secondly, also when I was allegedly at Rhodes studying a bachelor of the Victoria Hotel, I did one of my majors in drama was voice, and what it did is it teaches you how sound is created, and once you understand how sound is created, you can almost deconstruct sound and then reconstruct it. So what you do is you listen for and look for specific aspects of a voice. So for example, if you look at somebody like Mangosuthu Buthelezi,
mm-hmm.
he has a almost a stammer in his voice. So when he's talking, I'm not prepared to be a part of this conversation. It's not.
Got it.
F.W. de Klerk had one word that he couldn't say, and that was towards.
Towards.
Yeah. It is the policy of the National Party to continue to move towards a new democratic South Africa. And you just, all you've got to do is take that, as you say, the cartoonist, that nose. You know what I mean?
But these are real people. You made people up.
Oh,
I mean, you'd base them on, I will never forget. And it was one of the things, I think I was about 21 years old. I could even have been 20. And you were doing your show. And afterwards, I was working upstairs at 702 and came down to you. I said to listen, this Professor Wim Beerkes,
yes,
has got to be one of the funniest things I've ever heard in my life. Please, you've got to bring him in more. I mean, I was just a fan. And I remember he was just one of those characters. I could see what this guy looked like, even though he didn't exist.
Yeah, he didn't exist. we created characters. I mean, Wim Beerkes was one. There was a Simpiwe, the taxi driver.
Yeah.
The thing with characters in radio, the great thing with characters, and this is something I learned from John Burks when I was working on his morning show, is that you can get away with murder because the characters can say anything.
Yeah.
And it's not attributed to you.
Right.
Everyone goes, oh, geez, did you hear what Simpiwe said today?
Although these days, and comedians have told me the same, they struggle because people will quote you out of context now. People will, now there's social media, they'll take a recording, they'll say, this is what Jeremy said, even if it was you in voice.
Yeah.
There's no appreciation for that irony anymore.
Yes, no, I agree with you.
Right? So now you'd probably get into trouble for Simpiwe, the taxi driver.
I'll tell you a great story. This, in November, I was down at our place in Camps Bay, and I went through to Hout Bay the one morning to go to a hardware store to get some things. And thought, let me go and have fish and chips at the Lookout, which is a restaurant at the harbor. And I walked into the restaurant, and this guy came up to me to serve me, and he had his name tag on, and his name tag said, Lovemore.
Yeah.
And I said, Lovemore, what is your surname? And he said, I'm the famous one. My surname is Tibanda, and I'm from Zimbabwe. And I said, Lovemore, sit down. I need to tell you something. And I explained to him that I had created a character called Lovemore Tibanda from Zimbabwe. And Lovemore became legendary because we actually developed an entire family around him. I mean, he had sisters and brothers. He had his nieces. He had nephews and nieces. He had one of the families had twins, Get Out and U2. But it was, so this whole family was created. And about 2 days later, I had to go back into Hout Bay, and I went past the Lookout again. And he came up to me and he said, say, you are Mr. Mensfood. I said, yes. He said, firstly, let me thank you for the many tips I've got as a result of what you did. And secondly, I want to tell you what is my favorite story that I had. And he went on to tell me a story I'd completely forgotten about.
That's the thing, though, and I'm sure you still have it happen to you, where you walk, because you're recognizable. You see, you weren't just a radio guy, because you had done a lot of television as well, so people knew who you were.
Mm.
I almost marvel at, and I wish that we could wind the clock back and I could experience what it might have been to have been one of those radio guys who wasn't a public face. You know, a couple of people might have seen who you were in the newspaper, maybe.
Yeah.
But most people would only know your voice.
Mm.
And you'd stand in the queue like everybody else, but when you got to the counter, they'd go, oh my God, it's Jeremy Mansfield. But you were famous in terms of how, you know, they could tell who you were from what you looked like, and they could tell who you were from what you sounded like. So you were well known. You must still go around and people say, Jeremy, we miss you so much on radio.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually it gets boring, but it's nice to know that you made that kind of impact, which is why I said your show is a cultural artifact. People, you changed people's lives in small, imperceptible ways, far more than most politicians ever could.
Yeah, I think it's because radio is such a personal medium. And I think especially morning radio, because you know, your clock is defined by what you're listening to. You know, if it's 7:10, you know that this should be happening. So it does become a very personal medium, and people tend to think they know you because they listen to you, you know, and I still get people coming up saying, do you remember I phoned you once, and you go, yeah.
Actually, I just want to get the hell out of there.
But it's a, it's an interesting.
Do you have any regrets about any of that? Is there anything about radio, about your career in media, which was so public? Is there anything about that you regret?
No.
Any people you can't stand from then? People you don't want to see anymore?
There's plenty of those.
Yeah.
But they're all in management.
Speaking, preaching to the choir.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
When it comes to that, though, I mean, it's interesting, and it can't be an easy job to be a management, because when things go badly, you get the blame. When things go well, the talent gets the credit.
Yeah.
So it's a thankless job anyway.
Yeah, it is.
But and we've got to, as the people who were always being told by management what to do, we always felt like, and I still do to some degree, even though in some ways I suppose I am management now.
Yeah.
You need something to rebel against. You need something to fight.
Yes.
You need to get into trouble with someone.
Absolutely. I remember, because bearing in mind when Prime Media took over this thing called Highveld Stereo, it was a wallpaper radio station which didn't even have a telephone number. And it had to be radically changed. And also, the advertising industry wasn't interested in a large section of that audience because they didn't want it. So my job, my directive from the board was, you have to go on air and your job is to blow off the audience we don't want and attract the audience that we do. And the only way that I could blow off the audience that they didn't want, which was the conservative aspect of it, was to be in their faces. So I took a lot of criticism in the first year in the media for stuff that I was doing on air. But that was my job. I'd been told that is what I had to do. And I'll never forget, at the end of the first year, our station manager at the time, a guy by the name of Malcolm Fried, who I think is now with Bloomberg's in Europe, came in with the Broadcast Complaints Commission report to CASA for parliamentary purposes. And he dropped it on the desk and he said, just take a look at the index there. And it turned out that 51% of all complaints laid in radio nationally were laid against my show. And I said, okay, what are you trying to tell me? And he said, if it doesn't look like that next year, I'm not renewing your contract. So, that was quite a nice place to be in at the time. But I wouldn't, Gareth, to be honest, I wouldn't want to be in that space now, because radio to me has become, it's a different space.
Well, they're switching it off in Norway. I mean, someone, again, this is just an email I got yesterday from Josh. He said, just in case you didn't know, and he actually attached a screenshot of this website that he found the story on, Norway is switching off FM this year. They're switching it off. There's no more FM band.
Well,
people don't have radios in their cars. Everything's digital.
People aren't going there.
If it's not on your phone, it doesn't count.
No, exactly. No. And people are, I mean, the way forward in this industry, I believe, is people are looking at podcasts more than anything else. Because people know what they want.
Yeah, and they know where to get it now.
Yeah, exactly. And it's easy to find. Yeah. You know, in when I say the old days, God, I sound,
you're allowed to say it.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, I'm not that old. in the old days, you know, the old adage was people don't know what they want.
Yeah.
But now they do.
They do, really.
And now they can access it. And your youth, especially, are brilliant at accessing that. I mean, I look, when I was over in the UK just a few months ago, and I went down to see my daughter. The amount of stuff that she can access, just because she knows how to. And, you know, when data is that cheap, which it is, it's dirt cheap in Europe and the UK, These kids are, that's all they're doing.
Yeah, streaming YouTube videos. Oh, and
absolutely.
Whole universities are on YouTube now.
Well, I'm busy doing my master's degree at the moment.
Oh, are you?
Yeah.
Jesus, you are a busy man.
Through the University of Cumbria in the UK. And the amount of access that I have through Cumbria University's links with other universities, I can go into Harvard University's library.
Yeah.
And I can access documents, magazines, books, anything. The amount of information that is available these days is frightening. And that's actually what's making last time I studied was 1985.
Allegedly.
Well, allegedly, yeah. But, you know, that's what I'm finding really difficult with this master's degree is the amount of reading that I have to do. And it just, you start on one topic and it leads you through a whole load of others. So there's an incredible amount of reading you've got to do. You also, I mean, my last assignment at university that I did, I probably had 5 books as my bibliography. You now have to, in your bibliography, you're using YouTube, you're using URLs and all those sort of things. And you've got to get the bibliography right. Otherwise, it changes your level of plagiarism.
Correct.
And you're only allowed, University of Cumbria only allows you a 14% level of plagiarism. So if your bibliography isn't right, you're going to be over that level of plagiarism, not because you have plagiarized, but because you haven't credited it properly. So you do an assignment that takes you 3 days to put together. It'll take you a day to get the bibliography right.
Jeez.
So it's hard work.
So in some ways, I mean, again, there are good and bad things about this. The good is clearly that we have access to information we never had before.
Yeah.
We have access to people we never had before. Source material of every kind, but it's much more difficult to make sure that it's the real deal.
Yeah,
and this is the problem also with all this fake news and with people who are genuinely just confused as to who's real online and who isn't.
Mm.
You don't know.
You could create a name and just do whatever you want to.
Every third week, I get emails from Sexy Sally saying I'm coming around to your house this evening. Is that okay? And I get excited, and then it's not. So it's a fake. I get very upset. What do I do? Do I put it in the junk mail?
Yeah.
Do I flag her emails from now on? I mean, what am I meant to do? It's terrible. Now listen.
Yes.
When you and I were at Prime Media together.
Yes.
For a while, I was at 7:02. You were in the mornings on Highfelt. I was in the afternoons. We used to get on really well.
Yeah.
Then I went to mornings, and I thought something changed. I was clearly competition then.
Mm-hmm.
And then you didn't like me anymore.
No, it's not that I didn't like you.
I was competition.
You were competition, and I had to hammer you as much as I could because you were bloody good competition. You were the best competition I had. You were, if I didn't take you out, you would have taken me over. And that's a fact.
You're right, and the way you say it now, it all makes sense. So there's no hard feelings.
No.
But at the time, remember, I was 20-something years old. You were experienced.
Yeah.
You knew what you were doing. I kind of felt like we had a fun – I'd see you at breakfast. We'd sit and talk and joke around and laugh a lot. And then suddenly it was, you know, different – it was a whole different thing. I didn't understand it at the time.
Yeah.
So I felt like – oh, well, Jeremy's being an asshole.
Yeah.
You understand?
I know.
I've never got this off my chest with you. We needed to sort it out.
I absolutely understand where you're coming from. But understand that it's the same as I'll try and work an analogy here. We play in the same rugby team, and then I move to an opposition team.
Yeah.
And our first game together, I'm going to have to take you out.
Yeah.
And take you out hard, which is what I had to do. And I had to protect my space because you, with your talent, could have invaded that space. You could have taken my audience, and I had to protect my space. And one of the ways of doing that was to continue being very good on air, but also hammer you.
Yeah. No, okay.
So I had to.
Well done.
I had to.
I mean, listen, in the end, all's well that ends well.
And, exactly.
And when you left
and
there,
I still love
when you.
You
left there, I did take your audience.
You did, yeah. But that wasn't difficult.
eventually. You had to leave, but, you know, eventually we both got our way.
Yeah, no, but it's, yeah, I've always had a huge amount of respect for you. There are very few people in this country who can work different mediums, work radio and television. And the two people who I have the most respect for in that regard, who can work those two mediums, are you and Darren Scott. Those are the two broadcasters who I believe are the only people who can work radio properly and work television properly. And they're very, so you're far, few and far between.
Do you ever hear from the guys? Thank you for that. Do you ever hear, because I always get accused of I can't take a compliment properly. People who say that you, like you were in it for yourself. You got in, you did what you needed to do, and you got out. And there was, even from the business point of view,
mm-hmm.
people who said, oh, well, you know, if maybe things had worked out differently, there could have been a longer kind of tail to you. Did they ever say to you, you've got X number of years left? Or did you say to them, I'm out?
I said, without warning. I said, I'm out.
And they didn't know what to do.
Yeah, they didn't know what to do. Understand. Excuse me. Damn flu. Understand what happened in my life. In 2009, Jackie and I got back from the Seychelles after a holiday. And I went into the shower and I came out and I said to her, jeepers, it's cold. She said, no, it's not. And by 3 o'clock the next morning, I was shivering and shaking. And I was taken to Sunning Hill Hospital. And they thought I... And they weren't sure what I had. Blood tests didn't show up anything. And I was then in serious pain. And they gave me a cocktail of drugs and put me on Planet Zoig. And they carried on doing tests. And 3 days later, they came back and they said, you've got chronic lymphatic leukemia. And a week later, I went into my first chemo treatment. And I had chemo treatments for 9 months.
And you were doing the show then?
And I was doing the show.
Which is horrible, waking up at 4 a.m.
Absolutely gnar and knowing you're going into Donegordon to go and be put on a drip again and you're going to feel like absolute shite.
But you've got to be on air.
Yeah, exactly. After that happened, I think management got a huge fright because they suddenly thought, geez, what happens if this guy gets hit by a bus? Where do we go? And I said to them at the time, I said, you need a succession plan here. And they sort of, I'm denied and all the rest of it. And eventually they came back to me and they said, we've got a succession plan. And they told me what the succession plan was. And I absolutely disagreed with them. And they said, well, that's what we will be doing. And I said, okay, well, and I went and thought about it. And I thought, well, that's the case because to create that succession plan, it meant I had to be part of the succession plan. And if I don't agree with something, I'm not going to be part of it. So that was when I said, you know what, guys? I'm out of here. And that made my decision easy.
Do you speak to Sam? Do you speak to Harry? Do you speak to any of those guys
yes.
who are on the show with you?
Yeah.
You're all still mates?
Still see Harry?
Sam had a pretty rough time as well.
Yeah, she did. She was badly shafted. Taken from Highfield, put onto 702 when I believe I've heard, and I'm not saying this is true, but I've heard from very good sources that they knew what they were going to do and it didn't include her. But I think she's working on a new television show at the moment.
Yeah, and she's published a couple of really successful books.
Yeah, and she's a very good writer.
Yeah. She stopped the drinking.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. So, yeah, I've popped by, I don't know, last year sometime.
But you're not like, because people assume.
Terry Falkfane and I went and had coffee with her.
Well, you see, I mean, look, not everybody needs to be best of friends in order to be friends, and you don't need to be enemies just because you don't see each other every year.
Exactly.
I get people who ask me, you know, when I go to the petrol station, where's DJ Fresh? And I say, well, we don't travel in the same car together everywhere we go. We've worked together at five, but we're not joined at the hip.
Yes.
So when you don't see these people, they immediately assume there must be something wrong, which is not true either.
Well, I mean, I haven't seen you for, I think, since we did a conference down the road here in Rivonia. That must have been
2-3 years.
Yeah, I haven't seen you for all that time. But every now and again, we will engage via an SMS or, you know. You don't have to be joined at the hip.
Okay, well, we've learned a lot. Let's go through some of these things. You are running in the next election. If the DA decide to use you, you're available.
I'm available, yes. Okay,
and people will be able to vote for you.
Yes.
For the party, and then the party will make use of your skills.
Yes.
And you might even end up in Parliament. And wouldn't that be a fun thing to watch?
Yes.
Parliament's become a lot more exciting, but you could even add more to that.
I think so.
Mavs, can you imagine Jeremy and a Bladen Zimande and a Mangosuthu Buthelezi and a Julius and a Mbuyiseni Ntlozi argument?
Yeah, the script writes itself. The prospect is very exciting.
All right. So that we've got, you think you're happy.
Yeah.
But nobody really knows for sure, but you think you're happy.
Mm.
You've done a lot of exciting trips. You just saw a bunch of humpback whales.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very exciting, very beautiful story there. Everything's going well and you're not beating anyone, to be sure.
Yes, right. Just get that out the way.
Yeah. You have no regrets about leaving radio.
Nope.
You are very, very happy with the way that things are going in this country. So you want to stay here, but you want to make it even better.
Yes, I would like to.
And you also are very glad you didn't grow up in Port Elizabeth, because then you would have ended up completely ruined.
I'm very glad that I got the hell out of Dodge City.
Well, listen, Jeremy, it's always good to catch up. And we could sit and talk for hours and hours, but this has been terrific. It's nice to connect with you again.
Nice to see you as well.
Yeah, like it, man. And all the best to you.
And nice to see you looking very good.
Well, I'm trying, you know.
Yeah.
I had a nice little break over the holidays, and I'm ready to go. 2017, so we're gonna turn this year into something useful.
Good luck.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
All right, very good. And please, just be very careful about managing those investments, all right? I want you to worry. Don't mess it up. Too much that can go wrong. CliffCentral.com.